That highlights the point that Mike was making a little bit, that you busted out like the S&M version of that email to previous customers.
Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast with Craig Hewitt and Dave Rodenbaugh. This is a podcast documenting the journey as self-funded business founders and sharing lessons, tips, and tricks for businesses following the same path as ours. The journey is long and winding, but we're glad you're joining us for it. And now it's time to go rogue with Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. Today, episode 96, we have a very special guest from another excellent podcast that Craig and I are both tremendous fans of. Please welcome Mike Tabor from Startups for the Rest of Us, and some very special information about his new product, Bluetick, that we're going to hear about today. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
No, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. I think a lot of folks that listen to our show and for you and Rob also just kind of love hearing kind of what's going on with your business and kind of some of the inside scoop of what's going on. So for folks who don't listen to Startups for the Rest of Us, both those people out there, maybe, want to give a little background on kind of who you are and what Bluetick is and what you're working on right now, maybe?
Sure. So my name is Mike Tabor, and I've been running my own business since around 2005 or so. And about probably 2009, I got together with Rob Walling and started this thing called the Micropreneur Academy. 2010, we came out with the podcast Startups for the Rest of Us. And then in 2011, we launched MicroConf, which is a conference for self-funded and bootstrap software entrepreneurs. And it's kind of grown since then. We now run three of them. We run two of them in Vegas back-to-back, and then we also run MicroConf Europe. It moves around a little bit. We've had it in Prague. We've had it in Barcelona. And then this year, in I think November or so, we're going to have it in Lisbon. So that's kind of the brief rundown. I've had a bunch of different startups that I've worked on, some of them more successful than others. My last one was probably a massive flame out called Audit Shark. And then since then, I've been working on something called Bluetick, which is email automation software for following up with sales leads. So it's instead of marketing automation where you're sending out massive numbers of emails, this is really point-to-point emails that are going directly from your mailbox to somebody else's, and it will follow up with somebody until they get a response or they perform whatever action it is that you were looking to get them to do, and then it will back off and essentially let you take over the conversation or the sales scenario from there.
And Mike, I think that Dave and I were really keen to kind of pick your brain on two aspects of what you're involved in now, particular to Bluetick, in that I think you did a really good job of some early customer validation and getting kind of the feel and the need and the solution to that need with people, but also you're obviously heavily involved with cold email at this point. But kind of going back to the early customer validation, where did the nexus of Bluetick come from? Since you're not like a quote sales professional, is not like scratching your own itch, right? So where did this come from, this idea, and how did the process of validating it kind of evolve for you?
So it's interesting that you say that, because the idea for Bluetick actually did come out of sales stuff that I was doing. And I was having the initial idea was back in probably 2013 or so. And that was because when Rob and I divided up responsibilities for MicroConf, he works mostly with the speakers and works with them to make sure that they are able to make it and what their topic is and everything else. And then my responsibility and role is really to help land sponsors for the conference, work with them to make sure that they're getting what they need and they're going to be getting in front of the right people and how to present them and everything that goes with that. And what I found was that I would send an email to somebody and we might have either an initial conversation or I need to get that initial conversation going, and I'll send somebody an email and they wouldn't respond right away, or they just wouldn't respond at all. So then I'd have to go around and reply to them again and say, hey, have you had a chance to look at this? And sometimes they requested a rate card through like our support email address, and sometimes they didn't, or sometimes something just came in through a form on our website. But the reality was I would would send them an email, it would go off in a black hole and I wouldn't hear anything and I'd have to follow up on it. And my thought at the time was, well, if I developed a tool that did this automated follow-up process, it would be great for conference organizers. And I kind of looked around at the marketplace and try to evaluate what it would take to build something like that and whether or not it had any legs, whether it would go anywhere. And what I had a problem with was wrapping my head around the fact that conference organizers, they do this and it is important to them, but I couldn't figure out a pricing structure that would actually work for it. So even for MicroConf, for example, I might pay $200, $300, $500 for something like this because if it's bringing me in $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in sponsorships, it makes sense to pay money for something like that so that it makes my life easier and makes following up with those easier. Because even just one of them, that would be a couple thousand dollars that I wouldn't get otherwise. Mm-hmm. The problem was that because it was like a one-time sale, most conference organizers that I either talked to or ran into or had easy access to did not run a lot of conferences. So I wasn't really involved in that conference organizer space. And so I kind of left it on the back burner and I just said, look, this isn't really going to work out. And at the time, I was working on Audit Shark anyway, and I said, yeah, I'll set this aside. Maybe I'll come back to it later on. And I just didn't because I was, you know, heads down on Audit Shark. And of course, going through the process with Audit Shark, I also realized that I ran into this particular problem a lot following up with enterprise sales leads as well. So long story short, you fast forward a few years and I look at that and say, well, conference organizers was not the right market. It's not that the product wouldn't do what it needed to do. It was just that those people were the wrong fit for it. And there's lots of other places where that particular problem applies. But when I did the early validation, and I don't even really want to call it validation, but when I was thinking about this idea back in 2013, it didn't really make sense because I was trying to apply that scenario to the wrong people for which they wouldn't purchase it like on a repeated basis. They didn't need it every month. They needed it like once a year. So it was hard to figure out what a pricing model would look like that made sense for them, that wouldn't break the bank, that they were going to be able to take a chance on or be able to say, yes, I'm going to invest in this. Because, you know, $1,000 or $500 is a big ask. But if it's $50 a month, that's fine. But if they're only going to use it for a month or two leading up to a conference, it doesn't really make sense on my end either. So that's really where the whole idea came from. And I've since kind of expanded it into a bunch of different areas and talked to different types of people where it is much more applicable and a much better fit.
One thing I think would be super cool. So, you know, I mean, I don't want to turn this into like the traditional interview here because I think it's more fun when we're all sort of sitting around discussing, you know, strategies and tactics and stuff like that. So I would love to hear like what tactics you've been using so far to help you launch Bluetick and what tactics you've found from other people. Because at this point you have, you know, some number of beta customers that are online, myself included. I mean, surely you've learned some insights at this point about what other people are doing, what's working for them, what's not, what weird cases other people are trying to do. And that's the stuff I'd really like to get into here, Mike. Is that something you think you can share here?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, whatever you guys want to talk about, I'm open to discussing. So it's not a big deal.
I think that if I can narrow it a little more, I think this concept of like, I think Mike had a good solution for the wrong audience. So how to properly identify the right audience for your solution might be something interesting probably for us all to talk about within our respective kind of projects right now. Because I think it's a place where a fair number of people find themselves. They have a thing, but maybe they're talking to the wrong people or talking to the right people in the wrong way or something. So I don't know. But maybe an interesting spin on it.
Yeah, I think with that, for the situation I was in is that I was just looking at it from my own perspective. I was trying to solve my own problem. And because I knew one of the criteria that I wanted to focus on was, is this something that I could resell to the same people over and over again? And, conference organizers really didn't fit that model. And because I was just busy with other things, I didn't really think about how could it be generically applied or where were there adjacent markets where that would apply. And I think that just kind of being aware of that and being conscious of the fact that just because you think that these people are going to use it over here, that there's this adjacent market that wouldn't be able to use it or that would be able to use it in a way that does fit the criteria that you're looking for. And And I think it's just awareness of that fact. I didn't really look into it too much more. It's just I had that problem. I said, yeah, can I reach other people like me? And instead of thinking down the road, I just didn't do that is really what it came down to.
So we've run into this a little bit with Seriously Simple Podcasting. So right now, we have whatever number of customers, probably 2/3 of them are churches right now with our podcast hosting platform. And it's something that
really
two months ago I would have never told you that 2/3 of our customers would be churches, because in my world of podcast motor we have zero church customers, and they're all like people kind of like us and small businesses and startups who are solopreneurs or whatever. But these churches, they obviously have podcasts. They podcast their sermons out every week. So this kind of like fell into my lap, but it's gotten me thinking about like, how do I, like you're saying, kind of like take a step back mentally and say like, where else can I look that I'm like right next to, but because I have tunnel vision on, I can't really see, this adjacent market that could be a great fit. That's just waiting for my solution.
Well, I think there's another danger there, which is that you get several customers in the door who all fit that particular mold. Sure. And you think to yourself, how can I get more of those types of customers? And not really thinking about, well, are they the optimal customer? It's a difference between looking for the local maximum versus the global maximum. And it's very difficult to take several steps in a completely opposite direction from where you really should be, or at least, you know, kind of within the context of where you're at now, and then try to look for something that is even bigger than that. You can certainly run into problems. You can tank your entire business if you try to do that and it doesn't work out. So you do have to be a little careful just because the fact of the matter is that when you're doing that customer validation and you're working with them on features, they are going to want features that help them for their business, and it's going to translate to other people who are also doing the same thing. So you can kind of, you know, build features that lock yourself into that corner and not even really realize it. You just have to be aware that, like, you know, who is your ideal customer? And it's not just who's a good fit for the product, but who you want as a customer. You don't always want to attract certain types of customers.
Amen to that one. Yeah. So what steps have you taken so far with Bluetick then? And right now, who is the ideal customer for you guys?
I've tried to not make a decision, to be honest, which is problematic in two different ways. One is that like it makes it difficult for me to narrow down exactly what my message is to somebody who's never heard of it. But the other thing is that it makes it difficult to zero in on features that would be great to implement for, you know, a specific audience that might pay a heck of a lot more. So I've tried to stay away from the idea of turning Bluetick into either, hey, this is going to be awesome for cold email outreach, or this is going to be awesome for warm email outreach. I'm really keeping my options open at the moment and kind of working in both directions at the same time. The big drawback of that, of course, is that it mixes the messaging a little bit and it makes it longer to develop features, because I don't want to be developing things that don't apply to anybody. But when I am developing features, they have to be usable or applicable to both sets of audiences. And sometimes that's really, really hard to do.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, with Recapture right now, I'm kind of in a similar state, although, you know, a little farther down the road, since I have a fair number of paying customers at this point. And the result is I'm still struggling to understand what's the common thread between all my customers? Because when I go and ask them survey questions, I still get stuff that's like all over the map. Some of them will say, yeah, we want customized coupon codes, and some of them will be like, no, we want review boosts, and we want product recommendations and this and that. And so, you know, there's not like one consistent message. It's all noise, right? And you have to sort of decide, well, what is either what product do I want to have? Who am I trying to sell to, or what is the feature that's going to bring me the highest quality customers? And those are very difficult questions to answer even 2 years into it, because Recapture is a couple years old at this point. And I still don't have better answers than they had at the beginning. I mean, I talked to the dev guys when I first took it over, And they gave me a bunch of vague answers. And I'm like, oh, God, come on, guys, really? And then I ran a bunch of surveys and asked a bunch of questions and talked to people. And I'm like, I have no better insights now than I did before, because it's super difficult to get clear answers from people about those questions. So I still think that's a fairly smart approach.
So Dave, no, I have a question. So with Recapture, are you looking more at your existing customers or new customers coming in for an indication of kind of that barometer of like what a customer looks like or a good customer looks like?
The flow of customers that I have coming in right now is not as large as I want it to be. That's the thing I'm trying to really work on is customer growth. So I have a larger pool to work from of established customers. So naturally, it makes a lot of sense to go and look and say, all right, who do I have here? Which ones are the ones that are most successful with this product? And how can I get more of those? That's the template that I'm kind of following. Is that a template that you're doing with Seriously Simple Podcasting and Podcast Motor and Bluetick?
No. When I get customers who ask me questions, there's a difference between finding like somebody saying, hey, I want this feature, or like, you know, some of the examples you threw out were pretty specific, I think. Like, you know, I want to be able to offer coupon codes, or I want to be able to get this particular report. And there were a couple of other examples that you had. What I tend to do, or what I've been trying to do, is ask them, why is it that you want that? And it's more to help understand exactly what the value is that they're trying to extract out of that feature, because it may not be specifically that feature that they want, but something adjacent to it. And that's really where you're going to get the overlap. It's not when two people say, one of them says, I want coupon codes, and somebody else says, you know, I want to be able to offer, like a landing page so that somebody can get a discount on X, for example. It's like they both want to be able to offer a discount of some kind, and the effort there is to like help them land a sale. And it's like, okay, well, how can you make that a little bit more generic so both of them can use it and you implement the same thing that overlaps? And it just provides value to both of them by implementing that one thing. And as long as you can nail your messaging around it after the fact, that it doesn't matter. And I found a lot of places where somebody will ask for something and I'm able to kind of, I don't want to say twist their arm, but kind of guide them in the right direction where I'm really getting it underneath and at what it is that they're trying to do versus the feature that they want. Because a lot of them have something in their head and they say, I need this because they saw it in another product. And just because it was done that way in another product doesn't mean it's the right way to do it. A lot of times it's not. And they don't realize that because many of them just aren't developers.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, customers are notorious for not understanding what it is exactly that they want.
But they don't have the context either. Like they see things in their own context, not in the context of, okay, well, I've had conversations with 35 other people who also use a product like this, and this is what they're doing. And they don't have that context. So they have tunnel vision, and it's even worse than ours.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. On our end, we get a handful to 10 maybe feature requests a week. And at this point, we put them all in GitHub issues as a feature request and kind of just use like comments when we, you know, add another tally mark to that particular feature request. And I think that the measuring the volume of it for us, it's almost all new customers at this point. Is kind of the only thing I can say is I do a little bit what Mike says, kind of, you know, explain to me why this is particularly important for you, or why if we didn't do this, you would cancel your service with us or something like that. I think that customers are, I hate to say this, really forgiving, right? So like if the base of what you do is good, then the bells and whistles are a little optional by nature, I guess. I look at some of these feature requests of the non-essential features of a tool as really nice to haves. And we tread very lightly around them to build in things that aren't essential to our tool. Because I think you can get like this really complex tool really quickly that then is difficult to use for everyone, even if it offers that 1% extra functionality for someone. So for me, as a non-developer, I'm really conscious of that, as saying like, if we don't have this, are we going to lose like 1% of our customers maybe, but then are 70% of our customers going to be really happy with because our thing is so easy and simple to use. So we try to balance that, and I make the decision with our development team about like, if it's not absolutely necessary, can we keep it out and keep most people happy?
I would twist that a little bit, because you had said something to the effect of, you know, if you've got some core features that people are happy with, I think it really is about solving their core problem. So they're coming to you looking for something. And if you do a really good job at whatever that core something is, like in my case, abandoned carts for recapture, and you're providing a demonstrable ROI for that, or in the case of Bluetick, you know, you're dealing with the pain of following up, which just sucks. I mean, nobody loves going into their email and be like, all right, how many people do I have to go look through today to send a reminder email? Hey, just following up, Bob. You know, I mean, that part is the true value of Bluetick. And if I'm putting, you know, words in your mouth, Mike, please jump in here. But that's the stuff I think that they really want. And when you add stuff that adds more value to that core thing, then they're like, great. But if you just basically start saying no to things that don't have anything to do with the core thing, I've not gotten a lot of pushback from customers, particularly in the plugins, where they ask for some weird non-directory feature. And I'm like, yeah, you know, we don't really do that. So, you know, go see if you can find another plugin that supports that or whatever. And they're like, oh, okay. All right, that's fine.
But I think that's different than – so there's two different scenarios. There. One is an existing customer, and you're trying to prevent them from churning. And there's like any inertia with them, if they've already purchased it or it's a SaaS app and they're already using it, there's inertia there for them to switch to something else and find something else and doesn't have the same problems that you've already overcome. And there's risk in changing from whatever that product is. Then there's the other side where you're trying to grow the business and land more customers, and they're going to have similar types of requests probably. But if you tell them, hey, I don't have feature X, but your competitor does, or the product that they're already on and they depend on that feature, they're not going to switch to you because that is something that they may not be able to live without. So I think that those are two very different scenarios, and you can't treat them the same.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. I think it's a fair point. But I do sort of maintain that, it, like Dave said, if you solve the core problem that your solution should solve for customers, then I think people are pretty forgiving to a lot of the edge case details. So I think it kind of brings back to the kind of who are you talking to and what problem are you solving for different audiences a little bit. That if you really nail like this problem for this type of person, then the rest of the conversations probably get a lot easier, right?
Yeah, but I still think you have to be like super careful about what you're adding to the product, because I mean, this is something that I fell into as a trap with the plugins for a long time. People are like, put in this, put in this, put in this. And for a while, I was just throwing anything that anybody asked for in there for the first couple of years. And that was a total mistake, because most of the time it wasn't necessarily something that added value to everybody. Then I started going to the whole, all right, well, I'm only going to do the stuff that I hear from a lot of people. And I went and added that stuff all in, and that didn't necessarily move the needle. It wasn't getting me more customers. It wasn't necessarily making the ones that asked for them stay, because when they would come back for a renewal, they'd be like, yeah, we moved on. I'm like, okay. Thanks for letting me know. So, you know, you can't just feature your way to more customers. That doesn't work either.
Well, I mean, I think that's also a different context too, because if you look at the number of like how many other WordPress plugins are there that have like a, you know, offer a directory versus how many cold outreach are there? How many cold outreach tools are there? And there's like 30. I've got a spreadsheet that's got at least that, if not more. So right. I think that you have to be careful about making the assumption that those two scenarios are identical, because I don't think that they are. And I will say that like just making your product more complicated and adding more features is not a silver bullet, and you're probably not going to get more customers just by virtue of doing that. But if you overcome the objections that they would have to switch into your product, and you're able to do a better job of that than your competitors, then you're in a better position. And sometimes features will help you check off a box. Again, it can cut both ways. You can make your product overly complicated, and then they leave because it's complicated. I think that there's multiple ways to look at that, though.
Yeah. No, I agree.
So, Mike, you bring up an interesting point of participating in a competitive market where there's a lot of other players that are providing similar, at least, solutions. What's been your experience so far with Bluetick and other tools out there that are maybe geared towards slightly different audiences or solving your problem in a different way? How's that gone, and kind of where do you feel like you stand at this point?
I feel like there's certain things that Bluetick does that other products don't, and that's why people switch to it. And then, you know, like because they get fed up with certain problems that come up in other types of tools. So, for example, one is that if the whole concept of sending out cold emails or even warm emails is that you're following up if the person doesn't send you an email or doesn't respond in some way. And if you send an email and you've already talked to the person and the tool missed that email, that's a big problem, because then it totally destroys the illusion that you sent that email personally to them and they send something back that says, hey, I just sent, you know, we just talked, whether it was on the phone or, you know, the person just replied to some other email. If your tool does not catch that, that's a huge problem. And I've seen time and time again, like in various conversations, the people have said, hey, I'm switching to this because you've talked to me about how you do the synchronizations and all the work and effort that you put into making sure that you're verifying that before you send an email out that you know for sure that like you did not receive an email from this person and you can kind of safely send out that next one. I mean, I do a complete mailbox synchronization with my software with somebody's mailbox, and when they first sign up and they put in their mailbox. So I keep an active copy and I update it every 10 minutes. So over the course of between 10 and 15 minutes, my software is updating around 5 million emails and keeping them in sync with people's mailboxes. And that's just an insane amount of data, but it does it literally every 10 minutes all day long. And that's like, that's, I don't want to say that's like the secret sauce there, but like by doing that, by virtue of having all that data, that just puts the product leaps and bounds ahead of other people's. The other thing that kind of ties into that is that because I do it through IMAP, as opposed to being a Gmail only product, which a lot of the other ones are, they have to rely on Google's API in order to pull information out of somebody's mailbox. I don't have to do that. So because I have a little bit lower level access and I don't have to rely on somebody else's technology, you know, I am relying on IMAP, but IMAP is, I don't know, 20 some years old at this point. And there's pretty set APIs that allow you to get in there and get the data that you want. I have such low level access that I can do pretty much anything I want. So it gives me a leg up on what the competition is able to do from a technology perspective. Does that help me in marketing? No, absolutely not. But if I have a conversation with somebody and I explain to them, look, this is what I'm doing, they're sold. Like, especially if they've been using another tool where it's been missing things, because I have the ability to look at just about anything I want or anything I need to in order to verify, hey, this came in from so-and-so and this email's good to send.
So, all right, given that that's the case, what are you going to use as your USP for Bluetick at this point? Like, how are you going to position that in the market given that you've got these 30 other competitors?
Most of my value proposition is really around closing the loop with people and focusing on why it is that you're sending that next email. What is it that you want the person to do? And a lot of these other tools, if you get a reply from somebody, that's kind of the end. That's where those tools just kind of walk away and say, look, this is your problem now. We've got a response from them. You go do whatever you want. In Bluetick, there's this CRM component that's built right into it. So you can go in and you can see what emails have been sent from Bluetick, you know, what the person's replies have come back and when they came back, whether or not the person's opened those emails. We're working on making sure that you can see if they've clicked on links inside those emails. And because we have such low-level access to all of the mailbox information, we can show you every email that you've ever sent to the person and every email that they've ever sent to you. And that's not a level that most of these other tools get into. So those are the types of things that I'm focusing on. And in addition, the other pieces where closing that loop, being able to send them an email and expect them to perform some other task, whether it's a fill out a form or schedule a meeting, things like that, those can be fed back into Bluetick so that the email sequence will stop or move somebody over into a different email sequence once they have done that. And it can look very, very organic at that point because they signed up for a meeting with you. And then things just kind of happen automatically in the background. And those automations are really, really powerful. Those are kind of what people are latching onto at the moment.
Nice. So Craig, to you on this one, what are you using as your USP for Seriously Simple Podcasting right now?
We have it down to four words. Podcast hosting for WordPress is our kind of tagline and our USP. So we are very, obviously very tightly integrated to WordPress via the plugin, and our podcast hosting platform right now only works with WordPress users via the plugin. Because we're so tightly aligned, it makes the people that are already kind of, I'll say like in that channel, really easy to convert. It makes getting people from outside that channel or that funnel a lot more difficult. And if and when we do open it up, I think we'll see our conversion rates and things like that go down quite a bit. But right now, I think we're pretty tightly aligned with podcast hosting for WordPress, just because it's kind of the only thing we do. And it's working decently, at least for now, and until we open it up to be kind of a platform agnostic hosting platform, then I think we'll stick with it.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. How about you? I mean, I know that recovered, abandoned cart emails is something that at least a couple of people play in. Is being just a tool for Magento a good or bad thing for you right now, you think?
It's a mixed thing. You know, the more I kind of look into Magento and talk to other people and talk to other customers. When I was doing a whole cold email thing using Bluetick, one of the things that I was getting back, aside from the fuck you, I don't want to hear anything from you anymore, was I'm not on Magento anymore. Because, and then of course that spawned a conversation. I'm like, well, why is that? And they're like, oh, well, we moved over to Shopify. Hmm. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. All right. And I got that like three different times, which, you know, nobody else was telling me, oh, I'm moving over to WooCommerce, or, oh, I'm moving over to BigCommerce or Volusion or any of the other guys. Like, no mention of anybody else. It was all Shopify. So, you know, from a market standpoint, Magento is a very focused market. Like, that's a great niche, and you can easily find Magento stores. But the question then becomes, is there a future in Magento stores if people are actively looking to get off of there? Because my read on it so far is that Magento is not the place that people are making as many new stores as they are on Shopify. So that definitely changes the conversation of, am I an abandoned carts tool for Magento, or am I an abandoned carts tool for e-commerce? And I have multiple platforms that I support, such as Shopify and Magento.
Yeah, it's a very different conversation than what you were talking about when you bought the app, right?
It is and it isn't. I mean, I was aware of this particular aspect of it when I bought the app. I just didn't realize at what point the world was at and how soon I would have to adapt to that world. Mm-hmm. So that's the part that would kind of surprise me, is that I figured this would be something that I'd look at in maybe 6 to 12 months. But here I am 6 months in, and I'm feeling like I need to get there sooner rather than later, because that's where I hear people talking about. So, yeah. There's a whole convoluted thing going on with Magento 1 and Magento 2. I don't want to bore you guys with the technical details, but basically they said, hey, Magento 1, we're not going to support this after such and such date. And it's like 6 months from now or something like that, or maybe 12 months from now. I forget what the exact date was. But whatever it was, it freaked everybody out, because like they had to put a ton of money into a store to get a developer to build it for Magento 1. And now they're basically saying, yeah, you got to move to Magento 2 in the next 12 months. So all of a sudden, there's this huge capital expense that these big stores have to throw into if they want to migrate to M2. So there was like this massive uproar, and Shopify like jumped in and said, oh my God, all right, hey, look, if you have to migrate off, migrate to us. We're easier, blah, 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 blah. So they had this marketing campaign, which pissed all the people off at Magento.
No.
No, I know. It's like they went, they did this war back and forth. You could see their like ads that popped up. It was hilarious. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely a war for the hearts and minds of store owners right now. And it's unclear as to how that's going to sort of shake out. But in my guess is in the long term, it's going to be Shopify. So
yeah, I mean, just looking at their social presence alone, I mean, Shopify on Twitter has, I don't know, like 225,000 followers, and Magento's only got like 70,000. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to look at that and say, well, that's the reason, and they're that much more successful, or they have three times as many customers. I mean, you can't really, you know, make those distinctions or those analogies, but, you know, it does say something when their social reach is that far, because they can reach probably those Magento customers who are currently on it.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic of looking at the change in market overall. It's like sort of Squarespace to WordPress kind of analogy, maybe.
It just seems to me like, with given all the scale that's involved in either of those, I don't think that it's going to be one of those fast roads that goes from one to the other, and the entire ecosystem that you're kind of playing in right now is going to go away anytime soon. It's going to take a while, but it's just a matter of whether or not the market that you're playing in is growing and the rising tide, you know, raises all ships, or are you in one that's kind of stagnant and you could eventually run into a situation where you plateau and there's not much that you can do to grow the business just because of that plateau in Magento, as opposed to if Shopify were growing, you probably wouldn't experience that as quickly, but you never know. I mean, it's hard to kind of predict that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's certainly what I knew going into this. So, I mean, that wasn't, it's not all that much of a surprise. The only thing that was maybe surprising is just how fast that sort of trend came up and went down, I guess.
But I wouldn't call three people saying that, you know, indicative of like the entire market. I mean, sure, a few people came back and said they're moving, but you know, three people out of how many emails did you send? You know, it's hard to make those analogies and say, hey, this is definitively accurate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's statistically insignificant, but in terms of like the responses that I got, they basically fell into one of three categories. I already have something, or I'm not interested. Fuck you, I don't want to hear from you anymore. Or I'm moving to Shopify. Those literally the only sets of responses I got, and everybody else was just radio silence. So it's one of those things that, you know, you have to take some, I mean, you can't just sort of say, oh, well, that's only three of 600 people, so that, you know, it's not significant. Well, I have no other data. I have to work with something, right? So even in the presence of bad data, I have to try to make some reasonable conclusions there. So coupled with the other information that I saw, people talking about stuff on Twitter and so on and so forth, is that something that I can reasonably suggest is what is the right course of action? And so that's basically where that ended up coming from.
So I think the topic of cold email could be several entire episodes on their own, but be interested to kind of throw around some of the things that we've all seen and heard. Mike, particularly your perspective will be interesting around cold email and things that definitely do work and things that we've seen not work in the past.
Sure. Anything specific that you're looking for?
How do you feel about the breakup email?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I definitely have mixed feelings on it. I've used it in the past and it does work. But I also think that you have to be careful about who you use it with. I think that it's probably effective in certain cases, but the thing that comes to mind is that if you send a breakup email to somebody, you probably are not going to send it to somebody who you know. And it really does depend a lot on how you phrase that breakup email. If you're not familiar with this concept, or the idea of a breakup email is that you send somebody several emails in a row, and then your last one is, hey, haven't heard from you. I'm going to assume that you're not interested. And you can make it very short. There's an email that you can search for on the internet. I think it's called the breakup email or something very close to that, which is essentially just, you know, I'm going to have to assume your priorities have changed. And that's it. That's all you say. And usually that's used in cases where the person reached out to you and asked for information, and you try to reach back to them and schedule a meeting or something like that, and then they just don't respond. A lot of times that will bring them back to the table. The problem I see with a breakup email is that if you use it in a situation where it's a cold outbound campaign and you've sent them three or four emails already, and then your last one is, hey, I haven't heard back from you, I'm going to assume that you're not interested, you won't hear from me again. Essentially what you've done there is you've closed the door entirely, and you don't give yourself any leeway to touch base with them again in a month or 3 months or 6 months, when it might be a better time to contact them. Because if you do, then what you've done is you've made yourself into a liar. And who wants to be in business or do business with somebody who lies to them? Especially, you've literally said, I won't email you again. So you have to be very careful about when you send those emails and specifically what it is that you say in them. I think that a better way to phrase that, or a better way to use those, is to give yourself an out and say, hey, this is probably not a good time. I'll check back in with you in a couple of months. And that way you can still email them in a couple of months to see if it has anything in their lives or their priorities have changed. But at the same time, it gives you the opportunity to essentially close the door on that particular deal so that you're not necessarily following up with that as an opportunity that could potentially be active. And you could do that by sending them into a different email campaign or something like that. But you kind of want to put some boundaries around the emails that you're sending for that particular email sequence, so that you've got statistics that you can count on within a particular context, whether that's a month or, you know, a week, doesn't matter. You just want to be able to put those boundaries on it and say, within this sequence of 5 or 8 emails, this did not work. Now, it might work in 3 months when they're in a bit different position, but the point is you just want to put those boundaries in place so you can figure out what you should do next.
Yeah, I totally want to raise my hand on this one.
I love that
you
email.
Love the
though.
Breakup email?
No, I love the spin that Mike puts on it there at the end, though, because you can almost put a bit of, like, I don't say blame, but like almost like shame back on the customer or the prospect and be like, you're obviously not in a position to take advantage of our offering right now. I'll touch base in a couple months. Maybe your business will be in the right spot or something like that. I mean, I think you could really get creative with the it's not the right time right now aspect of that rather than, I'm going to shun you from my my cult world forever kind of thing. Because I think the breakup email is overly dramatic. But I think if you can put it in the it's just not the right time for us right now context, then that could be really cool. Yeah.
I don't think it's just that it's overly dramatic. It's that it gives them an out if they didn't want to write back.
Yeah.
Like if they were in a position where they're like, oh, I hate responding to these, just please go away. When you send a breakup email and it is definitive, those people are like, oh, thank God, this person is leaving. I'm never going to have to hear from them again. But if you leave that door open, it's like, oh, if I don't say something, this person's never going to go away. And at least you've got an answer at that point. Like if they reply and say, I'm just not interested, it's not going to happen. Okay, great. But that's what you wanted. Like you want to either open the door and be able to walk through and have a conversation, or you want them to tell you, go away and don't talk to me. But that in-between phase, that's what we're all afraid of. And that's what we don't want to run into. So that's what we're trying to establish. We're trying to get some sort of closure for this. And by closing the door, you give yourself that closure. But again, like I said, nobody wants to do business with a liar. So it doesn't give you the opportunity to go back to him down the road. So, you know, leaving it is, I will come back to you in a few months when you're in a better position to take advantage of this. That's a much better way to go, because then they know, oh, crap, this person's not going to go away. And if you do follow up with them in several months, then it shows that you're consistent. So then they may be more inclined to do business with you because you've already told them, I'm going to follow up with you in 2 months, and then you do. And that's compelling to a lot of people, because then you're following through and you're true to your word.
Well, I have a bad breakup email story.
I totally want to hear your breakup email.
I want to hear this too.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. All right, so breakup emails were new. You know, I feel like it was like I was young and naive, except I'm not really young, and I shouldn't have been that naive. But so I took the breakup email and I put it in a sequence, and I sent it out to old customers, recapture customers, who had signed up for the product but never converted into paying. So I had like a 2-week sequence that I put them through, and I don't remember if it was 4 emails or 5 emails. That's not really important. But the last one was a breakup email, and it was one of the, let's say, more forceful versions of that. I said, well, it basically said something to the effect of, well, I guess you like wasting money, so you won't hear from me anymore. It's basically the gist of it. And I specifically did this at the behest of a mastermind suggestion that was trying to get the customer to react. They reacted. They did. They did. This is the email that got me the most fuck yous. And it is also the email that I got from somebody who came back and said, you know what? I was setting up my store. I wasn't even ready yet when you were going through this, and I tried the trial, and I probably would have been ready in another month, but now I'm never going to talk to you again, ever. So I was like, shit, I totally screwed that up. Like, I could not have done worse on that one. Now, whether he would have actually converted as a customer or not, I mean, you know, there's always that talk is cheap, you know, factor to the whole thing. But if I'm getting these negative reactions out of the email, it's probably a sign that my email was not the right message.
Yeah, a little bit, little overly forceful at that point.
Little overly forceful. So yeah, I learned something on that one. Don't use it.
I'd have to go back and look to see if if you're the reason we implemented the do not contact feature. I'm not sure. I have to go back and double check that.
We might have been. I don't know. I started using that when I got those emails, and I'd be like, okay, they don't want to hear from me anymore. Do not contact.
That's excellent. But I think that highlights the point that Mike was making a little bit, that you busted out like the S&M version of that email to previous customers, right? So it's not quite the right audience to send a very
totally
drastic
wrong.
Email. Yeah, so that's a good learning
wrong.
Lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a good chance that I alienated some fraction of my previous customer base as a result of that. It's possible that most of them were just ignoring it, which I'm hoping so. I'm trying a different approach right now where I'm sending out newsletters to basically provide value and keep me in their brains so that every week they're seeing something in their inbox from me. And so far I'm not getting a lot of negative pushback. A few people have unsubscribed and stuff, but it seems to be better. Like, I've looked at the click rates and the open rates and engagement and so on and so forth, and it seems reasonable. So I think I found a better way to please my audience than say, I guess you like wasting money.
I have a name for this. So we did this with Podcast Motor early on. I call it the reach around. And it is giving a ton of value. And we did this via asking people to come on our podcast as guests, and it would be sort of a long way of having a sales conversation with a potential prospect. So we would send cold emails to potential customers to ask them to come on our podcast, and then at the end of the podcast episode, I would pitch them on kind of who we are and what we do. And Dave, I think you're doing a different kind of version of that with your newsletter, where you're providing a lot of value and just giving, and it gives you that opportunity to ask later on. And so you're really like warming up these people really well, I think. It's a great strategy. I think it's a much more elegant way of cold email outreach.
Your analogy is terrible, though. That's the worst name ever.
No, it's great, isn't it?
Oh, man. Got to work on that. You got to work on that.
But it's all joking aside, it's a nice, maybe warm option to, or warming up sequence for people, I think is a really nice way for people who aren't comfortable with really assertive, sequences that they would send somebody that's just sell, 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 but just offer, and then slip something in there and say, hey, you know, can we have a call? I'd love to talk to you about this or that. I think that's a really nice approach for people who are especially new to cold email.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's just kind of, you know, goes down the path of how do you turn somebody who is potentially a cold prospect into a warm prospect instead? I mean, cause that's really all you're doing at that point. Like initially they're a cold prospect and you say, hey, do you want to come on our podcast? And then from that, maybe there's some back and forth and maybe they look into you a little bit, but the reality is that by the end of those conversations, by the time they get to becoming a guest on your podcast, they are more of a warm prospect than a cold prospect. And that's a very different selling strategy. So anything that you can do to turn somebody from a cold prospect into a warm prospect, and you definitely have to be creative about that kind of thing, but those things will really go a long way.
Yeah. Have you seen any other examples? I mean, you have thousands or millions of emails going out now, Mike. I don't know how much you are engaged with your customers in crafting their messages, but have you seen anything else that your customers are using with Bluetick that's kind of similar to this warming up strategy?
Not specifically, at least not lately. I've kind of backed off a little bit from being heavily involved in the emails that people are setting up. Most of what I've been doing is helping people integrate into lead generation forms or other places where, let's say, that they have a drip account and somebody hits a certain lead score, taking those and sending them into Bluetick and following up with them individually. Because initially, when somebody joins like a mailing list, whether it's in Drip or MailChimp or AWeber or wherever, they're going to have almost no relationship with you. But then over time, as you send out newsletters and articles and things like that, their lead score will rise. And in Drip, you can track that based on the number of interactions they have either with your website or with open rates and things like that, and click-throughs inside of the emails. And once their lead score gets to a certain point, you can say, hey, this person is genuinely interested, or at least appears that way. They have a signature of somebody. And then take them and send them into something like Bluetick, where you reach out to them individually, because they've exhibited the behaviors of somebody who is interested and is more of a warm prospect than somebody you would send an email to that has never heard of you before. And because they come from directly from you, they have a different impact than they would if they came from like a mass email marketing automation software that has like unsubscribe links in it. And it's just you're moving them from that cold prospect into a warm prospect. But again, you have to have like things more at the top of the funnel in order to be able to capture those and bring those leads in.
Yeah.
Nice.
So Mike, I know you're getting into the public launch of Bluetick. You want to talk a little bit about kind of the road that's gotten you here and where you are and what the next couple of weeks and days look like for you guys?
Yeah, so interesting thing to share. I think you guys will be getting the sort of exclusive on this. I mentioned it shortly before we started recording, but tonight is going to kind of kick off what I'll be doing for the next 3 weeks, which is I'm going to be publishing a 21 days of behind the scenes of a SaaS launch, which I haven't seen anybody do that before. But what I'll do is every evening, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to record a 3 to 5 minute video, basically what happened that day, what things went right, what things went wrong, what things I'm trying to do moving forward, and kind of let people know what is going on with the Bluetick launch and just send them out through email the next day. I'll probably have like a landing page where people all end up with. I'm still kind of working out some of the details of that, but that's going to kick off tonight. And the intro for each video, I'm going to have a new whiskey to try that to kind of introduce people to as well. So if there's whiskey people out there, then they can take a look at it. But I've got a bunch of different bottles of whiskey, so I do not plan on repeating any of them.
Wow.
That's fantastic. I love it.
Nothing goes together better than whiskey and sass.
Well, the whiskey is to really drown my sorrows, because I expect that there's going to be a lot of things that I'm going to try, and they're just not going to work out the way I want them to. So I feel it's probably going to be necessary.
Well, here's hoping that you get some celebrations as well. I mean, I've seen a lot of – here's the post-mortem of our sass launch, but it's like – you know, they'll take 3 weeks and condense it down to a blog post. So hearing the ups and downs, I think, will be a unique and interesting take on it. So I'm looking forward to seeing that in my inbox.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Rob and I recorded an episode yesterday, but that doesn't go out until next Tuesday. So, you know, we did talk about it a little bit, but I think you guys will be publishing first. I will be sending out an email probably to my newsletter either later this afternoon or maybe tomorrow. But I'm still working on getting certain things in place to be able to send people updates about that.
Awesome.
And if folks want to check out more, Mike, about you and Bluetick, can you share kind of where they can head to learn more?
Sure. So my blog is over at singlefounder.com. And then on Twitter, you can find me there as well, twitter.com/singlefounder. And then Bluetick is at bluetick.io. It's bluetick.io. Those are probably the three most relevant places at the moment. And from my blog is where I will probably have a link where people can click over and join a mailing list where they can get notifications about the daily videos that I'm publishing.
Excellent. Well, here's wishing you tons of success on the launch for Bluetick. If you have any questions out there for us or Mike about email outreach, getting started on a SaaS, how to launch, then you can email us at podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you have a chance, we'd love it if you could leave us a review in iTunes. There'll be a link in the bottom of the show notes. Hope you have a great week. Until we talk again.
And that's our episode for this week. If you have any questions or comments, please let us know at podcast@roguestartups.com. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Rogue Startups. And be sure to visit roguestartups.com for full show notes on each episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd sure appreciate a review in iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.